And our speaker tonight is from Richmond, and help me give a warm welcome to Lauren from Richmond.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Good to see. Hi, everybody. I'm Lauren. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody on Zoom. Good to see you. Hi, Sam from Richmond. Thanks for logging on. It's so good to be here with you guys. This group has just always been so warm and welcoming to me, and I just really appreciate that. Anywhere I go, really, you know, anywhere I walk into AA, you guys are my family, and you pretty much know my story already. Like, I drank so much that I landed a seat here, and then I do the things that we do here in order to keep it. But Billy, thank you for asking me to speak. So I called Billy, or I texted him yesterday, and I was like, so is it an option for me to speak online on Zoom? And I was like, I just want to know if it's an option, and I'm going to pray about it for a minute and see what I come up with. And I was thinking about it. I was sitting in a meeting, kind of sitting with that. And I was thinking, you know what, Lauren, you know, you've gotten really wussy since you've gotten sober. Like, what would we have done for a drink, right? There is no doubt in my mind. And I definitely have driven in some crazy conditions to get what I needed for alcohol. So I'm like, you know, it's just being, I really need to remember that. And I really need to remember where I've come from. And so one of the things that helps me to do that is to come to these meetings, to hear you all talk and to share with me where you've been so that I can, you know, as we say, keep it green. But, and thank you, Angela, for riding up here with me. Some of the greatest memories I've had throughout my sobriety have been riding in a group of people up to this meeting and spending the time, and really the circle and the triangle part of it is that unity here, and the fellowship that I've experienced in this program is just unparalleled to anything that I've experienced outside. And it was something that I had been seeking my entire life. Like, I always felt, we've all heard it, I always felt like I never fit in, so uncomfortable in my own skin, just always so painful to be me. I had no idea why I felt that way. Until I came in here and I heard the language that you all were speaking, and I learned that that was the way I felt too. When I came in, my sobriety day is December 3rd, 2003. I have a home group. It's on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. It's a step study. I sponsor women. I have a sponsor who knows she's my sponsor, and I'm very active in service and have always been from the beginning. I really can't say enough about service work. Service work is something that really humbles me, because left to my own devices, I'm an extremely arrogant and entitled and prideful person. And having to be humbled to be of service to other human beings and to the fellowship and the unity here, that's something that I need to be a part of. You know, it's one of the pieces of the circle in a triangle. But anyway, so that you can just stop. If you're like me, you're going to think, okay, well, how old is she and how old was she when she got sober and all that business? Because that's what I do when a speaker talks. I'm like, okay, I think a lot about, you know, I'm just going to tell you, I'm 42. I got sober when I was 23, and I just turned, well, I'll be 42 on the 20th. And then I just turned 18, and I have no idea how I did that. The fact that I have not put alcohol or another mind-altering substance in my body for that amount of time is nothing other than divine intervention, because I had never been able to do that left to my own devices. And I tried everything. I even tried piercing my tongue, because you're not allowed to drink alcohol once you pierce your tongue, because you'll get a tongue infection, thrush. I got thrush and ended up in the hospital on antibiotics. I mean, you know, I became a private investigator, because if you sit in a car staking out somewhere, you can't drink in a car because you need to be still and undetected, right? So I can't go anywhere. I'm in this car. So that didn't work, you know. I tried therapists, I tried pills, I tried relationships. Relationships are a big thing for me. So I am a person who has really exhausted human power. Billy knows, Lynn knows. You guys, you know, I really will exhaust anything I can before it doesn't serve me anymore to realize that I need a higher power, something that's greater than me to do this thing. I mean, you know, in sobriety, I have done that. I've been crazy here. You know, I've been engaged 7 times to men and women because I think that you can fix me, because I think that if I get the right relationship, that maybe I'll be okay. Because maybe if I get the right stuff, if I get the right job, if I get the right car, if I have the right person, then maybe I won't feel like such a piece of crap on the inside. And for some reason, for someone like me, it is just, I have to do a lot of things before I'll concede to a higher power, you know, and that's really the easier, softer way. But, you know, I like to make things very difficult and complicated. You know, I grew up, my mom raised myself and my brother. My parents got divorced when I was very young. I was three and my brother was a year and a half. And my mom always told us from the very beginning, you know, don't ever want to drink because you're going to become an alcoholic like your father. And, you know, I heard a lot of, I've heard a lot of people talk about what they feel like an alcoholic looks like. The only thing that I had to put a picture to was that it was my father. And I knew that he was pretty absent and acted pretty erratically, and that, you know, I didn't want to be like him. So I didn't think maybe I shouldn't put alcohol in my body and maybe I shouldn't drink. I thought I just need to figure out how to not be like him. It, even from an early age, it wasn't I'm going to abstain and not drink. It was I got to figure out not to end up that way. So you know, I'm doing things because I have this thing on the inside where I always feel disconnected. And I can remember as a kid being on the playground and looking at these kids playing together and thinking, what are they talking about with each other? And just wanting to get up close enough to see and to hear what you could possibly have to talk about with another human being. And I can remember, you know, right up until the time I got sober, looking at people who were going to their jobs or having conversations with each other in the store, just feeling like I have no idea how to participate in life and how to do that and to do what you people are doing. So the way that I got some relief from feeling the way I felt on the inside, I just felt like my skin was crawling and I'm screaming on the inside and I just want just to climb the walls. I started acting out. I started getting into a lot of trouble from the beginning, from elementary school. And you know, just was always kind of the bad kid, the center of attention, because what that did for me, if you have paid attention to me, then I felt seen and I felt heard. And then I felt like one of you and I didn't feel like an outlier. And what that also did for me was that took me out of the way I was feeling. That took me out of myself. I didn't know that at the time, but that took me out of the way I was feeling. You know, when I got to middle school, I started sneaking out. I started spray painting houses. I started smoking cigarettes. I found this thing called the Anarchist Cookbook. I don't know if any of you all are familiar. I see one person that is. So, you know, they taught you how to burn things and to make bombs and how to make drugs. And so I figured out how to make drugs from banana peels. Don't do it. It doesn't work, but I tried it. And, So I was doing that and I was smoking pot and, you know, I was also snorting things. I was snorting anything that was powder. I was snorting Tang and Pixie sticks. And I mean, really, you know, this is just the stuff that I was doing like in middle school because it made me feel different, you know, and some other people showed me how to do it. So it also made me feel a part of. High school, you know, I'm still sneaking out and stuff. At this point, I'm cutting because the pain that I'm getting from cutting, for some reason, the pain on the outside alleviates the pain that I'm feeling on the inside. So if I can just cut myself hard enough or burn myself enough or scratch myself hard enough, then that maybe the inside won't feel as painful. The other thing, so I really liked to listen to Rage Against the Machine and Nine Inch Nails. It's this kind of dark music because that also altered the way that I felt. You know, I'm a writer. So I started writing a lot of dark poetry, suicidal poetry back then. I found a box of stuff that my mom had in our house when I was growing up recently. And there was a poem in there. There was a couple poems in there, but it was from seventh grade. And it's like, lying in a deep black, wide awake, I pray that it's my soul he'll take at seventh grade, you know, and I don't think that's normal, you know, so I don't think that that's special to us. But, you know, and I think my mom was a really good mother. She just didn't know what to do with me. I was in therapy at the age of three with compulsive behaviors. And, you know, she just really had no idea what to do. So I've been in therapy off and on since I was three. You know, that never helped keep me sober. It's helpful for outside issues. You know, I'm not knocking therapy, but we just didn't know what was wrong with me. you know, I went on medication from an early age. Doctors are really great resources, but really what we were treating were things that were my alcoholism, but we just didn't know that. My alcoholism presented itself in these compulsive and obsessive behaviors before I even started drinking, before I even put a drink in my body. I don't know when I had my first drink. I had little sips of grandma's PBR when we were cracking crabs because my family's all from Maryland. So we're all big crab pickers and beer drinkers. So I'd have little sips, you know, she'd lay it down on the newspaper and pick it up. But I had my first drunk when I was 16. And it was a bunch of girls that I wasn't really friends with, but I was really excited that I was invited to this slumber party because, I felt like maybe they accepted me. And so I wanted to do what they were doing. And we got there and somebody's older brother had gotten a bunch of alcohol and bagels because we were told that you're not supposed to drink on an empty stomach. So the alcohol that we had, it was Zima and Fuzzy Navel. And I don't know if you guys have ever had it, but Zima tastes like Sprite. And Fuzzy Navel, I don't even remember what that I remember what it tastes like coming back up, but I don't remember what it tastes like going down. But I drank to oblivion right out the gate, drank to oblivion. Ended up naked in a closet. I'm a naked drinker too. Naked in a closet on the phone with somebody, taking them hostage. And, you know, that's pretty much how my drinking ended too. But, when I woke up the next morning, vomiting bile and feeling disgusting and whatever, I didn't think I shouldn't do that again. And I didn't even really think that, oh, this is my magic elixir yet. What I did think is I can't do that again until I can have a limitless supply. Because my mom was like a detective. She always found out what I was up to. And so I knew intuitively that I could not drink again until I could have enough, until I could have as much as I wanted. So I kind of put a bookmark in that's what I want to do. And continue to do other things, snorting the things and smoking the things on the side until I got a chance to go get away and drink the way I wanted to at college. Before I went to college, I had a little stop at the ER because I took all the pills in the medicine cabinet and ended up having my stomach pumped. And the reason that I did that was not because I wanted to kill myself, but it was because there was a question of whether I was going to be able to attend this college because there was some financial insecurity. And it was looking like maybe I would have to cancel and not go. And so I wanted my way. So I took all the pills in the medicine cabinet. And it wasn't because, like I said, it wasn't because I wanted to die, but I wanted my way. And I will do anything I can to manipulate you. And I wanted my mother to feel sorry for me and to say, okay, well, then you can get what you want. And I did things like that, you know, all the time to get my way. And I remember when she came to pick me up in the hospital, you know, there's charcoal everywhere, blood is everywhere because they tried to initially put the tube down my nose and it didn't work because I was fighting them. So they put it down my throat and it caused me to have a nosebleed. So there was just blood everywhere. So when my mom came in, she thought I had slit my wrist. She didn't know what had happened. So she just saw the blood. And, you know, I'm a mother now, so I can't imagine what that does to a mother. I have a little baby, she's 9 months now, but you know, I don't know what that does to a mother. Hopefully I'll never have to find out. But you know, I got my way, I got to go to college. I went to Longwood, which I call Shortwood because I was there for a semester and got a 0.78 and was asked to leave. Because I'm me, I'm entitled. And I just think that you're going to give me grades and I just think for some reason that the bad thing is not going to happen to me. So I think that I'm invincible too, you know, so I'm doing all kinds of crazy things and putting myself in all kinds of crazy situations. The campus police knew my name before school even started. I was caught swimming naked in the fountain. And, you know, I just thought that was a great time. And I will tell you too, I'm a bar drinker. So I got a fake ID when I was 17. So I've always drank in the bars. You know, for a woman, we can get pretty resourceful and crafty about getting free booze. And that was what I used. So I used people, you know, to get what I wanted. So I'm at Shortwood and I'm discovering that blackouts. So I love blackouts. So right when I got there, I'm drinking. And my favorite thing to drink at this time is Bowman's vodka. because I can take Bowman's vodka has the plastic bottle. So you can take it from fraternity to party to party, and you can fall down and get your drunk injuries, but you're not going to bust the bottle. You're not going to break the bottle. It's fine. It's going to survive. So that was really convenient for me. It was also like $10 or something really crazy. I could never keep track of, like, people say like a quart or what, I don't know. It was just the biggest bottle I could get, whatever that is. So I would carry that around with me. But, you know, the blackouts made me also, I discovered something. So I'd wake up in the morning or come to in the morning with all these injuries. I had no idea what had happened. I had no idea who I was beside, whatever. But what I discovered was I really liked the attention that I got because it made me feel again a part of, and it made me feel seen. Because when you were telling me, I can't believe what you did last night. You did this crazy thing, you know, this is what you did. It made me feel like I was a part of. And it, you know, I did not feel any guilt, shame, and remorse at that time. You know, it was too early in my drinking career. But also, at that college, you know, I put myself in a situation where, I was, a part of something, in this fraternity. So what happened to me, in this fraternity, I should, and I would tell other women to go to police, as a result of putting myself there. But because I knew that if I went to police, I would not be able to drink at that fraternity any longer. I didn't say anything to anybody about it. So I just kept going, and I got to drink like I wanted to. And that was my choice. So I get kicked out of Longwood. I come home, I, enroll in community college. And, you know, it's a game of finding out which classes I can actually get to and which ones I need to withdraw from. So which ones are early enough or late enough in the day that I can get to, and, you know, and which ones can I withdraw from a refund? Because it's all about my drinking at this point. Only I don't know that, you know, I don't have the language yet to understand that. So, but it turns out that I'm actually not an idiot. So I actually made Dean's List at the community college. And it was probably because it was on my dime and because I was paying for it, I thought maybe I should apply myself a little bit. But what was happening was, because I was living at my home and because I have that detective mother, you know, she's starting to get the look. So I'm starting to come home, crawling home in the morning with the look. And everybody knows the look that their family gives them, you know, just utter disappointment and despair when they see you coming in the morning or whatever time it is. And that look was too uncomfortable because I felt like it was a mirror having to take a look at myself. So I decided to do a geographic, and I went to Nag's Head, and I moved there with my best friend. And we were supposed to be there for the summer. And I lasted, I mean, gosh, not even a month before I had slept with everybody's boyfriend. I had like burned every bridge, spent all my money, because at this point too, I'm starting to think it's uncomfortable for me to drink by myself. So I'm going to pay for your alcohol if you will just sit next to me on the bar and validate my drinking. Because at this time I was starting to see like, okay, I'm starting to snort things so that I can drink longer. And I'm also, when I'm starting to feel sick, I'm making myself throw up so I can drink longer. So everything is about the longevity of the drinking, you know, before I pass out. And I've got this credit card, which is just like gold to me at this time. So I'm able to put, you know, everybody's drinks on that so that they can make me feel better about my drinking. And if I can surround myself with you, then that makes me feel better about my drinking. But I was telling Angela on the way home, I came back to my little shack one day, I don't know what time it was, at one point. I went to go crawl into my bed, and there was pee all in my bed. And it's like, that is the difference between like when you egg somebody's house and you TP somebody's house. Like when somebody pees in your bed, it's like when you egg someone's house, they do not want you, like, leave now. So it was, you know, almost a month, and I left. And that's how my world had started to become. Things had started to become very small for me. And I made friends very quickly because, you know, I'm a charismatic person. So I can make friends really quickly and have friends wherever I go. But then once you discover who I really am and you find out who I really am, you're not going to be friends with me for very long, you know, because I'm really going to find out how to get over you. And I'm just trying, you know, I'm just using you. You're just there as my prop, you know. And So I was telling Angela on the way up here too, speaking of props and using. So I was at this fancy bar because one of the things I like to do to fool myself toward the end of my drinking is to drink in fancy bars and top shelf liquor, you know, because maybe if I have the Sapphire tonic, then it won't, you know, won't end me up in these sordid places, you know, if I have the fancy stuff. So this man comes up to me and he offers me a bunch of money to come home with him. And I'm like, how dare you? Don't you know who I am? I can't believe that you would treat me that way and think that I'm that person. And then meanwhile, fast forward like an hour later, I'm going home with someone else I don't know for free. Like, it's just ridiculous. The things that, so it's like the part in the Big Book when it talks about moral and philosophical convictions galore. I can tell you when I walk into the bar that I'm this person. And then once I start drinking, all bets are off and I'm the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I'm a completely different person. You know, I around this time too, there was this bar downtown called Tiki Bob's, and it was like the popular place to go. And there was one Christmas where I was still underage, and I was at this Christmas party and I was with a popular bartender. So I thought I had arrived, right? So I felt like I was super cool. And so I went to this Christmas party with the popular bartender, and I ended up coming to in a hotel room by myself without any clothes on. And the hotel room was in disarray. And I knew that he had put something in my drink because I was not drunk. And when I came to and my mom and my brother picked me up, they really wanted me to go to police. But again, I didn't, because I knew A, I'd put myself in that situation, but B, if I went to police over that, I knew I would not be able to drink in that bar anymore. You know, I knew that I had been seen with the popular bartender at the popular bar. And I knew that if I did anything about that, then I wouldn't be able to drink how I wanted to. So I just swallowed that again. And I am starting to get some stuff from family. It's like, maybe you should take a look at your drinking. There's one point where I sign a contract. My mom and my therapist give me this contract, and on the contract, there are these conditions. And some of them are like, you can have 2 beers and that's it. No liquor in a night. And that's it. So I signed this contract and I'm really hoping to stick to it. And the next morning I wake up signing this contract. I wake up in the hospital with alcohol poisoning. Like, that's what happens. Like, I can have every intention of drinking like a lady, and it just doesn't end up going my way. I was doing this stuff. So I'm a big liar, and I had to keep my lies straight. So I had these notebooks that I called liaries, and one was for employer and employee or coworkers, one was for friends, and one was for family. And I'd keep my lies in these different notebooks, hoping that I could keep this straight. And I would scribble my lies on those bev naps that you get in the bar, and then shove them into my purse or my wallet with the intention of transferring the lie into my liaries the next morning. And that was just one of the ways that I tried to fool myself. You know, I already told you about relationships, trying to control and manage. But at this point too, I thought maybe I should get married. So I take my first hostage. And I mean, poor thing, you know, also around this time, I think I tried, or I wanted to start to try and get sober or not drink. I was not willing to put down the other things. But so, and it wasn't, I don't think it was, it definitely wasn't because I had hit a bottom, but just because I wanted everybody to leave me alone, really. And really because I wanted the life. And so I went home and I looked in the phone book and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous and called Intergroup. God bless Intergroup. I don't know, do you guys have 24-hour phone watch here? It's a beautiful thing. We have it in Richmond. You can call 804-355-1212 any time of day, and another AA will pick up the phone. So somebody did that. I went to my first AA meeting as a result of that. Picked up a white chip, started picking up chips there. Looked at the steps you guys have at the wall on the wall, looked at the first step, said, okay, I got that. And then went straight to the ninth step and said, okay, I got to show everybody how great I am. Started making amends. And that's how I ended up with my first fiance, was as a result of my own idea and my amends process. So I convinced him that he was going to save me. And that's the other thing too. I really genuinely thought that somebody was going to walk into the bar and just save me off the bar stool. Like I thought that maybe if I was just in the right place at the right time, if I was in the right bar, then maybe someone was going to take me away from my life and my misery and how I was feeling, that I needed to be rescued. So I get him, he's working at the Pentagon at this time. I'm in Richmond. So that's about an hour and a half away. I convince him to move down to Richmond. He quits his, you know, gives notice at his job at the Pentagon and gets another job in Richmond. And then the transition from the time, and I picked out a ring and he's bought it. And the transition of when he's moving down to Richmond, I decide I don't want any of it anymore. And so I break up with him. And, you know, later on, he was on my supervised amends list. And I was told that your amends is to leave him alone. So anyway, so that's like that, that's what my ideas are, is I don't have any regard for you or your life or how you feel. I just want to get what I want. So needless to say, so I'm going to these meetings and I really just like to feel a part of. You guys are welcoming me. I've never felt anywhere ever like that before, but for some reason I can't pull off what you guys are talking about. I'm not really hearing it either. I don't get a sponsor. I don't take the steps through the big book. And, you know, I am smoking pot and snorting stuff on the side. And what happens with that? That's not my medicine. So left to my own devices without a spiritual solution that I found in these rooms, I have to drink again. The same me has to drink again. I was completely unchanged. As a matter of fact, I was getting sicker, because what happens is if I don't have my solution, which was alcohol at that time, and it is alcohol, you know, without a spiritual solution, I have to, you know, I start getting worse and worse. I start getting sicker and sicker because I don't have anything to take me out of me. I don't have a solution. So I had to drink again. I made it 11 and a half months and I drank again. And it was, you know, all those things that I thought I would never do. You know, I'd always driven drunk, always driven in blackouts, but now it was all the time. I don't know why I never ended up hurting someone else or myself in my vehicle, but I didn't. I don't feel like I'm more special than anybody else. I have no idea. Let's see. I started experiencing DTs, only I didn't know that they were DTs until I got here. I thought I had just had low blood sugar. So I'd wake up in the morning and just, you know, be shaking and thought, oh, I gotta eat something. So I'd get, go to Burger King and get a greasy meal or Waffle House or something. I'd get that greasy meal in. And, you know, that would take the edge off a little bit, but it still wasn't quite hitting the mark, and it really wouldn't subside. The shaking and the jitters wouldn't subside until I put another drink in my body. And that's the other thing too, is once I come to, and I don't know where I am or who I'm with or how I got there. And I don't know what happened, but it's like, it's almost like, you know, I got to get out before anybody else around me moves. Because if they do, then it becomes a reality. Like, as long as I can get out, it's still a museum here. You know, everybody can still look at this and it's a museum, as long as I can get out without waking anybody. So that's my game. And, you know, got to find my car and all this. And, what happens is I can fool myself about who I am and what I've done for a little bit, and I don't remember. And then as a little bit, you know, the four horsemen start to be on me. The guilt, shame, and remorse start to be on me. Everything starts to be on me and becomes really, really heavy. And I can't stand that. It's too painful. So I have to drink again. I've got to drink again. And I'm very clear. I became very clear on the fact that I was an alcoholic, because I understand that once I put a drink in my body, I can't stop. And also I have no idea. I'm drinking against my will. I'm telling myself I'm not going to drink again. I'm not going to drink tonight. I'm only going to have this amount of alcohol. And I really mean it. And I can't pull that off. You know, it wasn't until I had hit my bottom and I was in treatment. I didn't understand the second half of the first step, the unmanageability piece, because I thought, my life isn't unmanageable. You know, I thought unmanageability was losing stuff. And I had never earned, I'd never worked to earn. I had a job, you know, since I was 15 and always showed up at, but I had never saved money to earn anything. So I never had anything of my own. So I never had anything to lose. So I was hearing you guys talk about things that you had lost. I didn't identify with that. So I just thought that my life is not unmanageable. Once I was finally ready to be here. And at a bottom, I heard, you know, that what that looks like is really the insidious fear that is everywhere, that I can't open my eyes without the fear on me. I can't answer the phone because I'm afraid of it. I can't go anywhere because I don't know who I'm going to get bumped into and what I've done to them. I don't know the places that I can go safely. You know, I told you I'm back at it. I'm out and I'm doing all this crazy stuff. I don't have anywhere else to live at this point except with my mom. So I'm back with her again and things get really heavy. I'm starting to get physical with her. And she offers me an ultimatum, which was the greatest gift that I've ever gotten, which was you either get help or you don't have a place to live. I didn't even have a car. I mean, I was driving her car. So like I said, I didn't have anything that belonged to me. Thank God I still have her roof over my head. But she gave me the ultimatum. And, you know, because there's still some shred of me that thinks that, you know, that I'm going to be saved. She, you know, she's tells me she's already talked to my psychiatrist and I need to go to, detox. And that's the other thing too. So before I heard the solution here, I really just thought that I was crazy and hadn't found the right pill yet. And, so I just thought that I hadn't found the right thing to put in my body yet. And, so mom's like, you know, you gotta go to detox. But because I still think I'm going to be saved, I'm like, okay, well, I got to take my makeup in the detox because I might find him in there and he might save me. You know, it's just some crazy delusion, like finding somebody in the Tucker's like detox ward. So I stayed there for 5 days and, you know, I also had another wonderful gift, I was offered a place at a treatment facility. And I ended up paying that back after I got sober. That was part of my financial amends, was paying my mom back for that. But so I went to this treatment facility and I told you, you know, I couldn't understand about the second half of the first step until I was there. And it wasn't until I was at one of the meetings that they took us to, and I was trying to contribute to the seventh tradition basket and going into my wallet. And I wasn't contributing because I wanted to participate here, because I wanted to be a spiritual human being. And this is what we do as part of our spiritual program and action. It was because you might be watching me and I have to put something in the basket because you're going to talk about me if I don't, you know? So I'm going in my wallet to get something to put in the basket, and shoved into my wallet were all these Bev naps with the lies on them. And there was also a little nifty doctor's note in there too, because I had started to look, this was a legit doctor's note, but I had started to Google, you know, how to fake doctor's notes and stuff like that. So those were all in my wallet. And that was when it hit me about what unmanageability is like. I'm like, oh, I cannot live with or without alcohol. I have no idea how this works. So, you know, I had one, after I got into treatment, I had one little venture with pot. I thought that it was okay if I did that. And I told my sponsor about it. And she's like, yeah, that's not sober. So, you know, what do you mean? So yeah, that's not sober. So I did that at like 3 months after treatment. And then that was my last white chip. It was December 3rd, 2003. And I got active right away. And again, I didn't even know what I was signing up for. I didn't even know that I was going to have a life, you know, beyond my wildest dreams. But I knew that I wanted to feel like you looked. I knew that I wanted to be able to have a conversation outside of the meeting like you people were having. I knew that I wanted to be able to laugh and to smile and to look happy, joyous, and free the way that you people looked. And I knew that I wanted to be able to move through my life without fear. Now, again, I didn't know all the words to put to that, you know, until I heard you talking about it and really heard it with a sponsor. But I really wanted that. I really wanted to know what that handbook for life looked like and how I could get some of that. So I started going through the big book with my sponsor immediately. And I also was a little bit scared of my sponsor, and that worked to my advantage because I really wanted her to like me too. Because she was kind of ominous, and she was, you know, she'd been sober for a couple of years and she was around my age. And, you know, I really wanted her approval. So I was like, I'm going to do this thing. When we took the second step in the book, had a hard time with that initially, and the third step, because, you know, I've grown up going to church with my family, and I always felt a sense of a higher power in the church, especially when I sang with the, you know, the hymns and the service, and felt a connection there and felt something that was greater than me. Always got teary and choked up, and I didn't know why. But for some reason, I never felt like I was good enough to actually get what everybody else there had. And especially when I came here to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt like the things that I had done and the things that I had experienced, I felt like I wasn't good enough to get the loving God that you all were talking about. But then what happened is my sponsor started to share with me the things that she had done, but yet she also had this higher power that you all were talking about and that she believed in. And she had done the same things, some of the same things that I had done. And she had this all-loving higher power. And that gave me permission to have one of my own, my creator, come in and experience, you know, then the third step, taking the third step on my knees with another. And doing that was very scary for me, because opting to have someone, welcoming somebody else into a space of prayer is a very vulnerable place for me to be, you know, and that was the beginning. That and the fifth step were the beginning of the first honest relationship I've ever had with a human being, with my sponsor, because nobody else knew who I really was. You know, I'd lied to everybody else. I think that once we take the third step, I think a little bit of the God consciousness that we talk about later on, I think that really starts to creep in, at least for me it did. So I started to know, like, this, I have this little internal compass that starts to engage again. And I know, like, when I'm doing something, and God's will initially is something that I feel I have to do until it's something that I then feel that I want to do. You know, I do it until it's something I want to do. And in taking the fourth step, taking that action, I wasn't afraid of the fourth step, because I heard you all talking about it, and I wanted to, again, be a member here and feel a part of. And I wanted to do the work that you all said that you had done. And I had like 60 resentments, something crazy like that. And I found that I really was mad at everybody and everything, because you didn't treat me like how I deserve. Don't you know who I am? But then also I'm not enough for you and all this stuff. So I'm angry at everyone and everything. So that's easy for me to see the resentment. The thing that was difficult for me to see was the fear. So I came in very prideful, and I'm not afraid of snakes or spiders or heights or anything like that, you know, and so I have no fears. And my sponsor explained to me what fear really was. You know, are you afraid of failure? Yeah. Well, are you afraid of success? Yes. So it turns out I'm afraid of everything. I'm afraid of commitment, but I'm also afraid of intimacy. So I'm afraid of everything, and it's opposite. And so, put that down on paper. And then my conduct, you know, my conduct was something I kept under lock and key. That was something that I had a lot of shame around, a lot of shame, and that weighed very, very heavy on me. And taking the fifth step, that really freed me up from that shame. And the thing that I found when taking the fifth step and uncovering and being honest about all these things that I had done and thought, what happened was that I realized it was a little bit of the educational variety, and knowing that I didn't want to drink. I told somebody my whole life story, you know, in the presence of God. And there was no thought of a drink after leaving there, and nonsense. But that is a miracle to me, that I was that protected. I was safe and protected enough that when I told who I really was to another human being, I did not want to drink, that stuff that was so shameful. My character defects, the things that aren't serving me and are harming me and others enough are easy to get rid of. For instance, selfishness. So, you know, I can see that I'm using in self-seeking behavior. I'm using you and just all I want. I don't care really about you or relationships or whatever. And I can see how that's hurting you. I can see that in your face. So it's easy for me to ask God, to humbly ask him to remove my selfishness. And it's easy for me too, you know, when I'm at this point of despair and vulnerability, and after I've taken this action at the fifth step and the sixth step to then identify these character defects and to offer these over. The tricky thing for me is when a little bit of time passes and I start to look for some power in these things again. So I told you, you know, I look for power in humans. Another place where I found in the character defects, I really do feel also that they're like whack-a-mole. So I get rid of one and then I have another. One that took me a long time to be done with, it probably took me about 10 years in sobriety to be done with, is really to use my sex powers for selfish reasons. You know, it tells us in the big book, you know, not to do that, to use them for good. And I am a person who seeks external validation. So I seeked a lot of validation from other people for a long time to get what I wanted and to feel how I wanted. It took me a lot of broken relationships and damaging a lot of relationships in sobriety to be done with that. Something that I'm challenged with right now is my anger. I have a wicked, wicked temper, and my husband gets to see that firsthand. And, you know, I might look really sweet and outgoing and everything, but I am mean. And it has been a lot of prayer and asking for willingness to be rid of that, because there is a part of me that is still scared, that's still fearful enough that I think that if I use my anger, then I can have some power over you. But really what that's doing, really what that does is that any character defect that I'm active in separates me from you. And then what that really does is that separates me from God. So, you know, making my amends list, like I said, I'm so glad for supervision, for a sponsor. I bumped into that man I told you worked at the Pentagon and I was going to marry. So I bumped into him with my first husband at a restaurant in early sobriety. And because my sponsor told me, you know, you are to leave him alone. I saw him go to the bar, and my then husband at the time, we called the waiter over, and the waiter packed up our meal and we left. We got it to go. And I left without him seeing me, because that is my amends to him. I have him blocked on Facebook. Thank God social media was not around, because I'm an exhibitionist, like I told you, but I'm so glad social media was not around. And I hope I never have to go back out, because that's just going to, anyway. So I have him blocked. I have him blocked. And that's not because, you know, I'm protecting him, because he doesn't need to see me at all. My first amends that I made was to an old employer, and I made the hardest one first. I was directed to do that. And my employer asked me if I wanted my job back when I told her that I was wrong and listed how I was wrong and asked her what I could do to make it right. She asked me if I wanted my job back. And that is not how all of my amends went. You know, I owed the IRS $15,000 when I got here, because I thought I was special enough that I didn't have to pay them. And I started paying them $25 a month at a time until they were paid off. And now they owe me money. So, you know, I'm trying to collect. But, you know, there was one amends that I was really not willing to do, and I was prayerful about it, and I was several years into sobriety, and I had a dream. It was my father. So he's still in his cups, and I had this, and I felt very vindicated in my resentment, and I felt very justified and very, I was not able to set him aside completely and just focus on me. So, but I was prayerful about it. And there was a time where I had this dream. And this was back in the time of answering machines. And I could hear him leaving in my dream, leaving a message on the answering machine. And in his voice, I heard so much sorrow and sadness that when I woke up from the dream, I didn't have anger for him anymore. I just had compassion and empathy for him. And that's not me. You know, that's God changing me. I definitely believe that. And at 12 years sober, I finally was willing enough to make amends to my father. And, you know, I don't know if he'll ever get sober, but my side of the street is clean, you know, and I love him, you know, I love him dearly, and do not have an active relationship with him, but love him and pray for him, you know. The 10th step is something that I am doing my best, that I'm very good at. except for the hardest place is at in my home. That's the hardest place. But, you know, I have gotten a lot better, increasingly better at saying quickly, you know, immediately, not holding on to this anger and resentment and keeping score and collecting allies and all this stuff. I've gotten increasingly better with time and prayer at telling someone, praying, saying sorry right away if I need to, and then turning outward to help someone. My prayer and meditation these days, you know, I told you I have a daughter, and so I like to I like to make her a part of my prayer and meditation. So I like to take her outside in the morning and say, hello, God, hello, nature, hello, sky, and hello, trees and birds. And we say thank you to God for everything. Kind of like that book, if you guys have ever read Good Night Moon, and they're saying good night to the different things, like we say good morning to the things in the world. So I like to make her a part of that. And you know, I have usually about 5 minutes during the day. In the morning when I wake up, I immediately say, God, please guide my thoughts, words, and actions. And then I'm off and running. And then at some point throughout the day, I don't have a particular time, I'll take 5 minutes of silent meditation. And my prayer life is praying throughout my day, you know, is the prayer without cessation that Jerry Elkins talks about. Asking God for an intuitive thought or action when I need one. And it changes, you know, it's the 11th step is ever changing for me, and it has to be. You know, the God that I came in here with, or the God that I came to know in the beginning, is not the same God that guides me and protects me today. We have to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life, you know, because my disease is still doing pushups, like we talk about. You know, just because I've stopped drinking doesn't mean it's completely arrested. You know, it's continuing to grow. And I know that because when I stop doing these things, I get even crazier than I was, you know, several years ago. If I, you know, I could get away with some things before that I can't get away with anymore. I have to carry this message because this is what you guys have done for me. Part of the thing that, part of the reason why I'm still here is because when I started coming around, I heard my story and yours. You know, I started to identify and have that piece, that essential piece here, that identification, when I heard you all talking from the podium, and I heard you talking about how you thought, felt, and drank. And I thought, okay, I do belong here. And I felt that I could belong and deserve to sit in the chair. And, you know, I practice the principles to the best of my ability in all these affairs. And what that looks like to me is I go out into the world and I'm of service there. So it doesn't just stop for me in these rooms. Because of the life that I found in AA, and because of what this program has given me, you know, I'm of service in many different places today. You know, I volunteer at an animal shelter on Sundays, and I've done that for 10 years. That's the longest commitment I've ever had outside of AA. You know, I've found my passion here, and that's animals and writing. I'm a published writer. Like, I have several books, and I have been published in a bunch of different forums or newspaper. And I don't say that to brag. I say that because I don't know this person standing here. That's definitely not somebody that I ever would have thought could accomplish those things. It's not of me. You know, I never thought that I wanted to have children. And then I turned 40 and I changed my mind. And, you know, it's been because I'm so selfish. That's why. It wasn't because I didn't want that love and to experience that love, you know, it's because I wanted what I wanted all the time, you know, and, you have gotten to experience, you know, having a beautiful, healthy daughter, thank goodness. And, you know, marriage is, this is the longest relationship with another human being I've ever had. And it is my biggest teacher. It is my biggest teacher about what love and unconditional love needs to look like. It's my biggest teacher and how I need to love you, you know, despite any way that I'm feeling, despite if I'm, you know, tired or angry or hungry, you know, all that stuff, you know, I still can carry myself and act the way that God treats me and giving me that unconditional love. I can still offer that, you know, I really believe that. But that's only if I continue to do these things here. And I think that's all I have. Billy, thank you so much. And thank you, Matt.